What is the impact of October 7th, not only on the Middle East, but on global affairs?
I think that what October 7th did was it brought everything to the fore. It's important to remember the week before October 7th, when Netanyahu went to the United Nations, held up that map that had erased Palestine, when he talked about normalization being the greatest deal since the end of the Cold War, when the Israeli ambassador told Cannes Television that normalization with Saudi Arabia means the complete Arab abandonment of the Palestinians, when Erdogan, when he saw the Middle East corridor announced at the G20 in India only a few months back, that Biden celebrated and hailed, that would essentially connect India, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Israel, and then enter into Europe. We saw Erdogan shake hands with Netanyahu for the first time since Erdogan came to power in 2003. There was this sense that the whole world was moving towards a normalization with Israel over the heads of the Palestinians in the way that King Abdullah of Jordan had put it. We saw the UAE, for example, coming out and effectively saying that normalization is no longer for the Palestinians. Yusuf Al-Utaybah, the UAE ambassador, told, I think it was Brookings or Carnegie, when he was asked what has normalization achieved for the Palestinians, he said it hasn't achieved anything, as in UAE normalization. And he says now it's on the future countries that normalize with Israel to decide if they want to do something for the Palestinians. But not, don't fret, because now we have wonderful trade deals, and do you know how many flights there are now between Tel Aviv and Abu Dhabi? So October 7th happened in that particular context where the world looks like it's squeezing the Palestinians and hoping that this normalization over their heads will end the Palestinian cause in a way that favors the Israelis. And by that, what I mean is essentially rendering the Palestinians abandoned, hopeless, with no agency to continue with their cause or even insist on their cause. What October 7th demonstrated, and here I'm not justifying it or saying it was right, or, and I'm not making any comment on what about October 7th itself. What I'm saying is that what October 7th demonstrated was what Bloomberg and Erdogan and King Abdullah and all these other analysts had been saying, which is that you can't normalize ties over the heads of the Palestinians without risking a backlash. And Sisi himself is on record as having warned the Israelis that the way they were going about normalization, if you remember the report, they were saying that the Sisi had warned Netanyahu, there's something brewing in Gaza. And it's unclear whether he was warning them of October 7th or if he was telling them that Netanyahu, the way you're going about things, you know, it's going to result in a backlash. You're underestimating. And that's why I think that what October 7th did, it brought everything to the fore. Even the idea of Netanyahu and his bid to annex, to expand the Israeli borders. There's a lot of focus on the Israelis and what they're doing in Gaza, and that October 7th was the beginning of a chain of events. But people forget that the week before October 7th, Netanyahu was moving the troops and units around to position them near to the Jenin refugee camp and the West Bank in anticipation of a preparation to invade the West Bank and finally annex the territories. Remember, since 2019, he's been trying to annex, at least 2019. 2019, he tried. Trump told him, don't do it, so that UAE can normalize, so you give them some face to show the Muslim world and give time for UAE scholars to say that normalization is a good thing and to do all these interfaith things. And then when he wanted to go invade again, he fell out of power and Naftali Bennett became prime minister. Naftali Bennett tried to invade, you know, Jenin as well, began the raids. They killed Shirin Abu Akleh in the process, which ruined it. Too much, you know, heat. They had to stop the invasion. Netanyahu comes back to power and he wants to invade again. Now he's shaking hands with Erdogan. Now he's been to Saudi Arabia twice and met with bin Salman. Now that the UAE is saying Abraham Accords, we're not going back. Now that Sisi is more focused on domestic politics. Now that King Abdullah of Jordan is under pressure from the Saudis and the UAE to hand over custodianship of Al-Aqsa. Netanyahu believed this was the time to finally go into the Jenin refugee camp, go into the West Bank to invade. So what October 7th did was it categorically blew up the suggestion that there can be any resolution to the Middle East conflict without the participation of the Palestinians, without talking to the Palestinians, without having dialogue to the Palestinians. The second thing that October 7th did was expose the fallacy of international communities' approach to Palestine and Israel. The idea being that even when you look at the normalization talks between Saudi Arabia and Israel, if you notice, they went from talking about normalization in exchange for a Palestinian state to normalization in exchange for a pathway to a Palestinian state. The same kind of language that they used in Oslo, the same kind of language that they used after the Second Intifada to sort of suggest that they're doing something without actually doing anything. What October 7th demonstrated or brought to the fore is also the fallacy of these, to the extent that the EU now is sort of operating on its own in terms of trying to present its ideas on the Palestine and Israel independently of the United States, which is why when we saw Cameron call for this idea that we might recognize a Palestinian state irrespective of the Israelis, Spain came out, said we're ready to recognize a Palestinian state. Macron said we're ready to recognize a ceasefire. We have to talk about a Palestinian state. I think when these European countries are saying it, it's a reflection that the Europeans are coming to a conclusion that the American and Israeli approach to the situation resulted in October 7th, and therefore there needs to be new eyes and a new way of approaching the Palestine-Israel issue. So I think these are the two main things that October 7th demonstrated. Of course, there are side things, they're also significant as well in terms of, you know, media hypocrisy and the like. We saw, you know, New York Times, at the time of the recording, we're recording one day after New York Times published that Thomas Friedman article that we talk about the Middle East in the same way that we're looking at, you know, the animal kingdom and the like. But I think those two, in essence, the idea that Netanyahu was pushing for peace at the expense of the Palestinians, I think now people are saying that you can't have peace unless you talk to the Palestinians. Having said that, there are still attempts to install the Palestinian Authority into Gaza, which is still an idea of imposing, you know, their own way onto the Palestinians. But I think that the difficulties that Blinken is finding in that, there was a report that Netanyahu asked bin Zayed, the UAE, wa madrak, if the UAE could help with rebuilding Gaza. And bin Zayed is on record as telling Netanyahu, go ask Zelensky, because he's getting all this money from the Americans. You can't do all that damage and expect me to pay for it, because they're very frustrated with Netanyahu or the like. But the idea being that they're struggling to implement their way. But I think more broadly, those are the two main things. The idea you can't normalize at the expense of the Palestinians, and also the fallacy of the approach to Palestine-Israel, which is making what was once a united bloc behind Israel splinter off into different initiatives, which opens the door to a more in-depth discussion as to how exactly we should proceed on this.
I want to ask you about the resistance, is what we'll call them, or Hummus, for the sake of the algorithm, so the video is not demonetized or deplatformed. Given the current situation, what really were they expecting to take place? Did they think that they could capture these hostages and that Israel would actually negotiate with them in good faith for the lives of the soldiers and the civilians captured? Or have they been completely blindsided and surprised by the extent of the ruthlessness of the Israeli government and their Hannibal directive policy to murder their own people?
I think that when it comes to Hummus, I think that, first of all, it's important to remember the context of the previous question to understand why October 7th happened. There is a suggestion somehow that how did they not expect that this would be the response? But if you acknowledge that Israel was preparing to invade the Jenin refugee camp and the West Bank, the point is war was coming irrespective. October 7th just happened to be, call it whatever you want, a preemptive strike or the like. But the notion that it came out of nowhere is something that is denied now even by EU officials and the like. Like, everybody's aware that there is a context to what happened. Again, it's not about justifying or the like. It's about providing analysis of what actually happened. The idea that, you know, there's all this normalization taking place. Erdogan is shaking hands with Netanyahu. Bin Salman is ready getting ready to normalize. He's doing interview Fox News and saying we're getting closer every single day. And Netanyahu, understanding from all this normalization, that now's the time to invade Jenin refugee camp. My point is, war was coming. Netanyahu was about to prepare in the West Bank. And one of the reasons, one of the theories why there was no Gaza defense force when October 7th happened is because there are reports that Netanyahu had moved those units towards the West Bank in preparation for an invasion of the West Bank itself. So I think that's the first point. When we look at, could they not have predicted it? That question presupposes that the status quo was sustainable, when in reality the status quo was reaching fever pitch after Netanyahu was receiving all these assurances that he could do what he wanted with impunity. The second thing that's worth noting is that when you look at, for example, the Hummus and how they are able to continue firing rockets at the Israelis, I think Kissinger had a really interesting statement where he said the issue with fighting guerrilla forces is that a conventional army loses if it does not win, whereas a guerrilla force wins so long as it does not lose. And I think Ghassan Abu Sitta, I saw a podcast of him, I think he was talking to Thinking Muslim or somebody else, I think Ghassan Abu Sitta made a statement where he said that, you know, we win by surviving, we win just by existing. And I think that's very much what is frustrating the Israelis, because you think about it this way: Israel objectively has absolutely decimated Gaza. We're talking almost 30,000 killed, we're talking 10,000 children, we're talking, you know, mainly women, civilians, or like, we're talking about a genuine decimation of Gaza. But when you read the news, you don't get the sense that the Israelis are on the verge of any sort of victory, whether it's military or whether it's even like a moral or whether it's even a PR victory. On the contrary, the more Israel seems to be bombarding Gaza, the worse this image seems to be getting. Think about it. Israel militarily on the ground is decimating Gaza. But the ICJ ruling has said that Israel now has to stand trial for genocide. Biden was unable to get the case kicked out. 15-2 ruled that Israel should stand trial for genocide, and now that's moving ahead. Macron says it's unsustainable, we need a ceasefire, and he called for a ceasefire before even asking Biden to do so, separated from Biden. The deputy prime minister of Belgium is saying now we need to, Belgium is saying we need to put sanctions on Israel. Josep Borrell, the foreign policy chief of the European Union, is talking about consequences on Israel because they reject a two-state solution. These aren't the positions of allies who believe Israel is winning. These aren't the positions of allies who believe that Israel is gaining from what it's doing in Gaza. And that's the point that I want to emphasize here, in that that when we look at, for example, you know, Hamas and what they're doing, they're aware that as long as they survive, even today, before on the day that we're recording, I saw news that, you know, Hamas are conducting operations in the northern areas where the Israelis have insisted that they have full control, suggesting that every time they pull back, they, you know, it's like a whack-a-mole, you know, like they just pop up, and there are all these videos, and not only that, you see testimonies of Israeli soldiers going back to Israel and saying, you know, Israel is not telling you the full truth of what's happening, like we're getting kicked here by people in Adidas, you know, tracksuits and slippers that are just coming up and firing and the like. And I think it's less to do with the idea, I think the wording of the question might be changed a little bit, because the wording question suggests that, that, you know, the resistance is, you know, making gains or the like, whereas in reality, it's hard to look at what's happening and say the resistance is winning. I think it's more accurate to say that in this war, Israel has done so much damage to its image that even if it wins a military victory, in the long term, it won't actually count for much, because they lose more on the international stage in terms of its legitimacy, its interaction with its allies, the shift in public opinion. We're seeing it here in America. We're seeing under 35s now, they are no longer, you know, supporting the Israelis. When they asked TikTok, they said, please limit the reach of these pro-Palestinian content. The TikTok chiefs, they said, listen, like, we'll show you the data. It's not the algorithm. It's just the new generation is pro-Palestinian. Kamala Harris's daughter, I heard she's raising money for Palestine as well, showing you in the same household there is this generational shift. And that suggests that the next generation will not be as ideologically inclined towards Zionism in the way that we see today. And that's why sometimes I think that if Israel one day, when it reflects, or Netanyahu, or indeed Benny Gantz or Yair Lapid, I think if they were offered a choice to go back and choose to maintain the monopoly over the narrative or decimate Gaza, they would choose to preserve their monopoly over the narrative that's been emphatically broken at this time. It's also worth noting that even domestically, you know, when you look at Ehud Olmert, the former Israeli prime minister, or you look at, you know, Yair Lapid, or you look at some of these other like Israeli politicians who are in favor of the ground offensive but turning against Netanyahu and openly saying that there is no strategic victory for us here. There's no, even Lloyd Austin, he said, you know, the civilian casualties means that you may win a, I can't remember the exact phrase, it was like you may win a tactical victory but not a strategic victory, or something along those lines, saying, you know, this short-term gain you're getting won't benefit you in the long term. And I think that's the point. As long as Hamas continue to, you know, pop their heads out, it makes the Israelis even more difficult. It makes it difficult for the Israelis to assert any sort of victory, which is why I think that one of the reasons we haven't seen a ceasefire yet is because although Blinken and Biden are now more inclined towards a ceasefire, Biden is worried about the elections. He's looking for any masjid in Michigan that will receive him, looking for any Muslims who will sit with him so he can take a photo where he can, you know, sort of show himself listening to them. There are still, you know, and but the point is that I think it's less that Biden and Blinken are now averse to a ceasefire. I think they're certainly pushing for one in their own way, but I think they're struggling to find a way out for the Israelis in a manner that allows them to claim that the Israelis won. And that's why they keep talking about the day after Gaza, in this idea of the trying to impose the Palestinian Authority on Gaza. The final point worth mentioning is actually this. A couple of weeks ago, maybe 10 days ago, my mind's a bit of a blur with all the traveling, but Netanyahu made a statement which was interesting. In the statement that he said that we don't recognize a two-state solution, or we won't accept a two-state solution, contradicting Biden, who had to make excuses, no, that's not what he meant. But Netanyahu was humiliating Biden in this regard. Netanyahu also made another statement in which he said, now is not the right time to hold elections. And I think that was a response to Blinken, because Blinken, when he went to Tel Aviv last time, met with Yair Lapid, and he met with Benny Gantz, and he met with some of the oppositions. And it was said he did that without consulting Netanyahu, suggesting he was trying to get them to push for elections so they could get Netanyahu out of the picture and then orchestrate a way out for Israel, where it looks like they won. Even now, we're looking at the ceasefire deal. Hamas have said that they will reject the deal Because although they agree on the hostage release and hostage exchanges, I think it's female hostages for 1 month and the males for 1 month, Netanyahu is so concerned that this will be considered a defeat that he wants to insist on being allowed to continue the military offensive after, you know, the truce ends. And I think that's revealing in and of itself, that Netanyahu finds himself in a position that for all of the Palestinians he's killed, for all of the buildings he's destroyed, for all of the hospitals that he bombed, he doesn't feel like he's anywhere closer to rescuing his political future. He still believes if the war ends now, the Israelis will force him out of office. And I think that says everything you need to know about the resistance, about Hamas, in that they have nowhere else to go. They have nothing to lose. The Palestinians have nothing to lose. Each more land gets taken each time. For them, you know, it's an idea. You squeeze them, you squeeze them. And I think even when we look at, you know, the events of October 7, I always said, and I say this to some friends of mine, you know, non-Muslim friends, people who are just learning about Palestine, Israel, you know, they say, yeah, there was a party taking place, you know, and the party was attacked. But think about it this way. How desensitized do you have to be to the Palestine-Israel issue that a party or a rave at the walls of the world's biggest open-air prison, that a party at the walls of what can be only be described as a concentration camp, concentration of civilians in one place, it's just considered normal, that you can just say the sentence, there was a party at the walls of the concentration, and you say it without any like, oh, wait a minute, like, that's insane, you know, like Germans dance, they're having a rave, you know, next to, you know, the concentration camps where they used to put the Jews in or the like. I know some people don't like the comparisons, but in reality, we're looking at the same. It's a persecution of a people by virtue of what they look like and who they believe, the same way that the Nazi Germany persecuted the Jews. And that's why I think that to answer this question very simply, I think that for all the destruction that we've seen, I think it's very telling that the Israelis are yet to come up with a narrative that suggests they're winning, while the Palestinians are very easily coming up with narratives to suggest that they are the ones, in fact, winning. The Palestinians are saying, you know, public opinion has shifted, Israel is under pressure, now it's a genocide regime, the ICJ, South Africa, Global South versus Global North, and all the Europeans. The Palestinians can point to things and say, you know what, a genocide is taking place, but the world is starting to hear us now. And I think that's why the Israelis are panicking and trying to spend millions to get, you know, TikTokers and influencers to push back against videos like this. I think that it's very difficult to predict the future or what happens. And the reason why I say this is that if you look at history, take the Algerian liberation, for example, of France. You know, we had two main movements. We had Masali al-Hajj and we had Farhat Abbas, and they were the dominant trends, you know, in the fight against the French or the like. But the group that liberated Algeria ended up being the Front Libération Nationale, the FLN, that popped up in 1954, rendered the other two like obsolete, and then ended up delivering the independence. Not to say the other two didn't have a role, but that was the final stage that happened. In other words, it may well be next 5-10 years we don't have any Hamas and we don't have Palestinian Authority. It may be like a new movement. I think that in terms of short term, I think what we're seeing is a move not necessarily towards a ceasefire, but a phasing out of the conflict, phasing out in stages, releasing the hostages, keeping a state of war in terms of name, while in substance, no war. Very similar to what we saw in Yemen, where the Houthis and the Saudis didn't have an official ceasefire because they didn't renew it, but there was no real fighting taking place in those 2 years when they were negotiating. The reason the Saudis didn't want to sign the ceasefire is because they felt it would acknowledge the legitimacy of the Houthis, which they later on ended up acknowledging anyway by sending their ambassador. But the point is that it may work. They're trying to find a solution whereby they can tone down the war or reduce the, or phase out the fighting to buy time for Biden to convince the Muslims that in Michigan and these other six swing states, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Florida, is somebody told me Florida might be one of them, but I'm not entirely sure. But in any case, to give Biden time until November to convince the Muslims that although he committed a genocide, Trump is going to be worse, and therefore they should forgive the genocide and go vote for Biden. I think there will be a phasing out of the fighting, primarily because Biden wants a solution in which he can claim that he supported the Israelis so he can have the Zionist bloc on board without saying that he allowed Hamas to continue or Hamas to continue ruling Gaza. The idea being that this is why when you read all the news, at least today, you know, before I entered, it's all about how do we get the Palestinian Authority back into Gaza. All these policymakers are saying we need a ceasefire, but we need to think how to get the Palestinian Authority back in Gaza to make sure that the Hamas can't say that they survived it and they're still in Gaza and they're still ruling Gaza as well. How they achieve that, I don't know at all, to be honest. There's also the other angle in that. Although everybody else is talking about a ceasefire and the Israeli allies are trying to pressure them for a ceasefire, the Israelis do appear to be pressing forward. They're trying to go to the Rafah crossing. They're trying to take over, you know, that border from the Egyptians as well. There is this sort of, you know, this is a golden opportunity to annex Gaza. This is a golden opportunity to ethnically cleanse it. This is a golden opportunity that might not come again, whereby we can kick out the entire population and take this land and attach it to this holy land of Judea or whatever they call it, and the point. And I think that in many ways is trumping the pressure to push for a ceasefire, and why Netanyahu is also resisting it as well. So although it looks like we're getting closer to a ceasefire, the closer we get to a ceasefire is also, we're also seeing an increased ferociousness of the assault on Gaza itself. But to answer your question simply, I think it won't necessarily be a ceasefire, although it could be. I mean, no one knows the future, but it could be a ceasefire. But I think that more, as it stands, it's more likely to be a phasing out of the fighting that allows room to make sure they don't recognize Hamas in Gaza, and allows a state of war where there's no fighting, but there are negotiations to bring amenable Palestinian parties to rule over Gaza itself. Having said that, there's also the other alternative, which is that when you look at the provocations that are taking place in the West Bank, remember, there's fighting in Gaza and genocide in Gaza. There's also flare-ups and a lot of, you know, fight taking place in the West Bank as Israel tries to take advantage to go into the West Bank itself. There could be another intifada, you never know. I mean, it's when you squeeze a population so much and you don't give them recourse, the only what ends up happening is you end up having this explosion lashing out as well. So in reality, I'm not entirely sure what happens next, primarily because it does appear that there's still a push to provide an environment of impunity for the Israelis. And although Biden is concerned about the elections in November, Biden is receiving assurances from certain Muslim groups in America and Muslim leaders in the region that Muslims will not punish him in November. And I know that sounds extraordinary, but you know, I saw a tweet from, you know, an American Muslim who said that Biden still has a chance to win back the Muslim vote if he shows empathy and understanding, you know, about their feelings, that even after genocide 30,000, this American Muslim believes they still hope to vote for Biden because a man who committed genocide is better than a man who might commit genocide. You know, Biden might be better than Trump. I'm not endorsing Trump in any way whatsoever. I'm saying that Biden, on the one hand, is reading in the paper that the Muslim vote intends to punish him, but he's being told by Muslim leaders and some Muslims in America that we won't punish you because we're so scared of Trump that we're willing to let go of the genocide. And I actually think that's one of the reasons why Biden, before he calls for a ceasefire, is testing the waters first domestically, sending his campaign manager to Michigan. Can we find people to meet us? Can we find Masajid to meet us? Can we find these people to sit with us? And if he can find them, he will say, you know what? The Muslims are not a united bloc. They're divided. I think I can win enough of them in November. I don't need to call for a ceasefire. Let me expand this window and allow them to commit genocide further. Having said that, I do think the window of genocide is closing. It's abundantly clear the shift, there's this unprecedented shift taking place in terms of how people are approaching the Israelis. And it does appear that Netanyahu now appears to be the sole man standing in the way of a ceasefire, because he fears that if he ends the fighting now, he will be kicked out of power. And that Biden wants to see him out, Erdogan wants to see him out, France wants to see him out, Benny Gantz wants to see him out, Yair Lapid wants to see him out, the families of hostages want to see him out, the protesters in Tel Aviv want to see him out, they all want to see Netanyahu out. And I think it's more about how do we market this in a way that won't allow your podcast to say that the Israelis lost. And I think they haven't come up with that scenario. And given that, you know, they believe there's still hope to mitigate the worst of the consequences, let's see how long it goes. Having said that, ceasefire talks are still ongoing, so you never know what will happen.
Many Muslims are disappointed with the lack of action by Muslim and Arab states in the region. Some have called for war, while others would just like to see some sort of economic action. I personally don't think people understand the weakness and dependency these nations have on Israel in the West. Without trying to make excuses or provide justifications for what appears to be an absolute betrayal of the Palestinian people, I would like to go through the interests and positions of the Middle Eastern nations so that people can gain a deeper understanding of the complexity of the geopolitics of the region. I'd like to start first with Turkey. Erdogan has been quite vocal in his condemnation of Israel. However, many are disappointed with his lack of ability and or willingness to take economic action against the state of Israel. So can you break down for us Turkey's relations with Israel and the U.S. to give us a better understanding of Erdogan's sensitive position?
Let me make it clear. We're analyzing the position. We're not justifying it. You asked me to analyze the position. You didn't ask me my opinion on the position. And we're going to continue in that regard. I will just say one thing, because I noticed in your question about understanding that they don't have the power to do whatever. You know, my job is a political risk consultant. There are many governments that they are also clients, and I advise their ambassadors or sometimes their foreign ministries or the like. when you hear the questions they ask, we might believe that the Muslim world doesn't have agency. Their questions suggest that the Muslim world does. A lot of the questions are, what if this Muslim country does this? Mm. What if Turkey opens more military bases? What if, you know, like they express a concern over a scenario that agency might actually be deployed. And in asking that question, they are affirming that they see agency in the Muslim world, even if the Muslims don't see it, which is why I'm a firm believer that the Ummah always has power. It's just that there are conditions to manifest that power, and part of that condition is perseverance in the struggle that results from manifesting that power, which I think many of the Ummah are not necessarily ready for, particularly those in the West. I think other parts of the Ummah they are. But having put that aside, let's put ourselves in the position of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. You find gas in the Eastern Mediterranean, and you believe that you have a right to access that gas. The problem, however, is as a result of you standing with the Arab people in the Arab Spring, you alienated nearly everybody who is around the Mediterranean. Egypt, Syria, Israel, Lebanon not so much, but you know, not only that. You, in order to access it, Greece also wants access, so does Cyprus. There are maritime issues, so you're falling out with Cyprus over the Turkish issue in the north because they don't want to recognize, you know, they talk about two-state solution or one state or the like. And the Greeks are upset at your position on Cyprus as well. So if you look on the map, Greece doesn't like you, Cyprus doesn't like you, Israel doesn't like you, Syria doesn't like you, Egypt doesn't like you. So that's literally everybody that's relevant in that Mediterranean. In 2019, the UAE-backed warlord Khalifa Haftar in Libya launches an attack on the capital. If Haftar takes the capital, you know for a fact that your entire maritime interests in the Mediterranean will be at the mercy of those countries that don't like you. They will cut you out of any deal. And the proof is that Israel, Greece, and Egypt tried to sign their own economic zone with regards to access in there. And that's why when they tried to push back against Erdogan's access to the Mediterranean, that's why Erdogan announced that unilateral maritime border with Libya, where he literally just created a border and said, I'm allowed access because this is the border with Libya. Erdogan wrestles with the Israelis on that front, and he's wrestling with Saudi, wrestling with UAE, wrestling with the like. He takes in 5 million Syrian refugees, knowing it might cost him politically, domestically. I remember being in Turkey in 2014. I know anecdotes are bad form, but tolerate me just on this one. I remember being in Turkey in 2014, 2015, and I remember Turks on the streets saying, you know, Erdogan gives them free education, free healthcare, whatever, and I have to pay for it. I do believe Erdogan took in those Syrian refugees knowing he would pay a political price for it. 2016 coup. Then 2019, when he has the elections, it's after Libya. So 2019, you have Libya. I know it sounds like I'm going like everywhere, but you'll understand like, where it's coming to. 2019 comes. He's wrestling in Libya. But then he has the mayoral elections in Istanbul, Ankara, and he loses them because of the refugee question. The reason why I say the refugee question is because on the night before the vote, Bin Ali Yildirim, the AK Party candidate in Istanbul, Erdogan's candidate in Istanbul, he does a last gasp effort to try to win votes by coming out and saying, I promise to deal with the issue of the refugees as well. Something that shocked everybody. I remember sitting in Istanbul that night, I was having dinner with Turkish friends, and one of them says to me, Sami Bey, I'm really sorry. Like, I'm really, really sorry. Like, it doesn't reflect our real position. I said, dude, like, politics is what it is. Erdogan wakes up one day after raising interest rates for 20 years and says, interest rates is haram. So I need to bring them down now violently. And the currency starts crashing. So the economy starts crashing. And then he has a presidential election, existential crisis. If he loses, the sense is that everything will be reversed. And he throws everything at this presidential election. Six parties unite with Kılıç Darulu. Erdogan wins the election, but the nationalists also get a sizable vote. So it's clear that people didn't vote for Erdogan, they voted against Kılıç Darulu. I'm talking about the Muslims specifically, because Muslims are 35-36% bloc. It's clear to Erdogan that these Muslim bloc did not vote in support of Erdogan, they voted in fear of Kılıç Darulu, expressing their discontent with what Erdogan is doing. Erdogan says to himself, look, you know what? I'm struggling. I've got economic crisis. The Americans are on my back. They won't sell me F-16s and they're treating me badly. EU is not moving on the issue of the customs union. I'm wrestling in the Mediterranean. I need the access to the gas. They're trying to cut me out of that gas. Right? He tried in 2021, he tried to invite the Israeli energy minister to Istanbul, and then the invitation got ruined by when Israel bombed Gaza again. Erdogan says, I'm stuck, I'm wrestling with Russia in Central Asia because they're upset that I set up the Turkic Council and I'm gaining influence in Central Asia, and Putin is trying to make a point. He sent troops to Kazakhstan to rescue the government, to send a message to the regimes that you might be getting closer to Erdogan, but I'm the real power here in this region. Erdogan says, you know what? I've done 10, 11 years of antagonism. I need the breathing space. Like, I need the breathing space. And then he gets shocked and stunned when he reads the news that at the G20 summit, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Israel, and India have announced the Middle East corridor, which is going to be a direct challenge to the Belt and Silk Road of the Chinese. The Chinese are angry that it's been announced at the G20. And Turkey realizes, or Erdogan realizes, that the whole economic landscape of the region is going to change and Turkey is going to be kicked out of it. Like, it's going to. So Erdogan says, you know what? I need to slow down a bit. Goes to bin Salman, tells him, yeah, bin Salman, I'll kick out the Khashoggi case, please. And I ask if I'm sorry. Like, I'm sorry. Let's just reconcile and let's make peace. Bin Salman doesn't forgive him because bin Salman believes Erdogan is the reason everybody found about it. Erdogan could have just ignored it. So bin Salman tells him, on security issues, I'm happy to have some Bayraktars. Beyond that, I'm not. Don't count on me too much. UAE sees a golden opportunity. They invest 50 billion. And the UAE commentators, they say, look how the Sultan is selling out his allies now for us. And you know, the Turks, you know, they say, look, we're stuck, we can't do anything. And they tell, you know, their Muslim Brotherhood allies in Istanbul, we need you to be quiet now on Sisi. And they thought it's a joke in the beginning, like it's a friendly. And then when they really start, they say, listen, no, like, we're serious. Like, you need to stop. So they start leaving Istanbul. Bin Salman, then Erdogan says, you know what, Mediterranean gas, I don't need to be antagonistic. Haftar is no longer, you know, taking over Tripoli because I intervened and the like. I want to make peace with Sisi so that I can agree on a deal on how we can extract that gas in the Mediterranean. And I want to talk to the Israelis to establish. So Erdogan says, look, I need a breather. I need to solve my currency. I'm going to talk to the Israelis about setting up a joint gas pipeline so we can all have access to the gas. I'm going to talk to the Saudis in the hope I get more investment so they can calm down in their lobbying against me. I'm going to talk to the UAE. They're going to invest and we're going to work together in Libya, in Somalia, these other places, in Ethiopia and Sudan, where we have mutual interests as well. Even in Sudan, they have mutual interests. Turkey does have contacts with the other militia that is backed by the UAE. And Erdogan says, look, Muslims just need to understand. I tried and now I'm struggling. Then Gaza, October 7th, takes place and it completely humiliates him because at a time in which he's trying to wind things down, he's now being asked to escalate. So he comes out and he says, you know, we want to be neutral and reconcile between. And the Turks get so angry at the stance that they start taking to the streets in protest, not only in support of Gaza, but in protest against Erdogan. There's a video that goes viral of a Turkish guy who says, Erdogan, you called us out in 2016 in the coup and we came out for you. Call us out for Gaza. What are you doing? And Erdogan eventually, you see his speech start changing from very neutral to he does a rally where he gives them the speech that they want to hear. But he's very careful. He says, I can't work with Netanyahu. I don't want to talk to Netanyahu. I don't want to deal with Netanyahu. I don't want to with Netanyahu. To give something to the crowd while telling the Israelis, guys, like, come on. Like, not now, like, of all the places. That's not to justify Erdogan's position. I truly believe, honestly, even analysis-wise, I believe that Erdogan does have convictions when it comes to Muslim issues. I don't think Turkey changes in the way that it's changed in the past 20 years unless you have conviction. I don't think you go to the Hagia Sophia for the first time in the history of secular Turkey the night before an election. I don't think a leader leaves Atatürk's grave, abandons, doesn't go there, and goes instead to Hagia Sophia. I don't think you do that unless you have conviction. I don't think you bring about those changes unless you have conviction. I do believe, this is why people say sometimes you're soft on Erdogan. It's because Erdogan, I hate the pragmatism and I denounce it and I think that it's wrong. That doesn't mean I think he doesn't have conviction. There's a difference between someone like bin Salman, who is proactively de-Islamizing the kingdom and showing no remorse for Gaza, for his personal interests, and between Erdogan, who pursues personal interests, but you can feel he's, you know, it's like, I wish it did not have to be this way. I think there's a difference between that. And that's why I think with Erdogan for Gaza, he says, one, what can I realistically do? What I think he's under heavy pressure for is that there are reports, and I haven't confirmed them, but there are reports that Turkey, that trade, there's accusations, and it went around in social media, and this is what put pressure on Erdogan, that trade between Turkey and Israel increased 30% since October 7th.
Increased or decreased?
Increased 30% since October 7th. Now there are reports saying that Erdogan is taking Israel off the export list. This was last week, taking Israel off the export list. There was a list that went viral in Turkey that listed companies that are trading with the Israelis. And there were accusations, you know, that people close to Erdogan, you know, that they were also involved in this particular trade. It also caused a reflection of what Turkey has done, or Turkey has done for Palestine. By that, what I mean is, Egyptians, albeit I think they exaggerate a little bit, the Egyptians say we fought two wars for Palestine, which I think is a bit of an exaggeration, because the two wars were not really fought for Palestine. They were fought for other reasons, that Palestine happened to provide an umbrella under which they were able to fight. One of the fights was for Sana, because it was taken by the Israelis and them. But you look at Turkey, like, even when they kicked out the Israeli ambassador, they didn't actually kick out the Israeli ambassador. Israel withdrew the ambassador because the Turks were so angry. And then Turkey left its ambassador for a few days and then realized it's untenable. I need to withdraw my ambassador as well. It's these things that raise doubts about Erdogan, and that it makes clear that Erdogan believes himself to be in such a situation that this October 7th came at the worst time. I need to tone down. I don't have the power to push forward. And that's why in reality he's become irrelevant to what's happening in Gaza and Palestine. And a lot of people are upset, like, with his stance. And even when he tried to justify it, in reality it makes it quite difficult, given that, you know, he's a lion in Syria and unable to do anything, like, in Israel itself. And it is, like, bitterly, bitterly disappointing to see Erdogan's position on it. And I think that, you know, some of my clients, they ask, after this genocide, will trade with Turkey and Egypt go back to normal, trade with Turkey? And I can't lie to you. I can't, in good faith, rule it out. I can't rule out that Erdogan will very quickly go back to normal trade with Israel. Because in his view, Israel is fundamentally important to Turkish economic interests. And Erdogan says, if I have to calculate it, the Turks will forgive me for dealing with for working with Israel if I provide them greater comforts. But they will not forgive me if I go against Israel and they suffer greater discomfort. And I think in reality, that's why, it's not that I'm soft on Erdogan, but I think he reflects a wider trend, which is like Pakistan, like Imran Khan, which is, you know, at the end of the day, Imran Khan made a good statement. He said, they're not coming after me, they're coming after you. I'm just standing in the way. The point being that it's an environment that lends itself to Erdogan making these conclusions as well, which is, if I knew the Turks had my back, if I did something on Israel, like they had my back, I'd probably do something. But I know if I go to Israel, the Turks won't have my back.
Switching over to Jordan, same concept in the context of their position. So 50% of Jordan's population are Palestinians. Despite outrage, we've seen Jordan continue to do business with Israel. Most recently, they allowed goods to cross into Israel from overland routes in the Middle East corridor, coming from the UAE through Saudi. And this is in response to the Houthi blockade of the Red Sea. Can you break down for us Jordan's position in all of this and help us understand their actions?
I'll be honest with you, and it might displease some people. I want to go easy on the King Abdullah of Jordan. And I tell you why. King Abdullah of Jordan is in a very difficult position. It's not to justify the actions, but to give some context. King Abdullah of Jordan is aware that what's happening in Gaza puts him in a very difficult position with the Palestinian population in Jordan. And actually, he's been one of the loudest to condemn what's happening in Gaza, and also coming out and rejecting the day after plans that Blinken has been trying to impose. Jordan has been quite blunt diplomatically that it deeply resents the US stance. And one of the reasons why Biden went back on the Congress bill that he proposed on the 20th of October, the $14 billion to give to Egypt and Jordan to take in Palestinian refugees, is because King Abdullah put his foot down and said, I'm not taking them in. Like, I will not allow you to drive these people out. Like, you can't. Like, it's a red line. The reason why I said in the beginning I'll go easy on him is because the greater threat to King Abdullah of Jordan is not actually the Palestinians or even the Israelis. It's Saudi Arabia and UAE. Saudi Arabia and UAE have been pressing the Jordanians to hand over custodianship of Al-Aqsa.
To who?
To them. So telling King Abdullah of Jordan, share the custodianship with us, with UAE and with Saudi Arabia. The reason that's significant is for two reasons. The first is that Hamad bin Jassim, the former Qatari Prime Minister, tweeted maybe a year ago, 2 years ago. The tweet is still up. He said, there is an Arab country that is buying land around Al-Aqsa and handing it over to the Israelis. There are testimonies from Palestinians that I've spoken to who say that UAE is buying land and handing it over to the Israelis. If you remember, there was a coup, attempted coup last year on the Jordanian king. And two people were arrested. The brother that tried to do the coup and Saudi's man in Jordan. The arrest of Saudi's man in Jordan made it clear who King Abdullah thought was behind the coup. When you look at why does Saudi Arabia want custodianship of Al-Aqsa? One day I was sitting in a room of diplomats. I know anecdotes are bad form, but tolerate me with it. And during the session, one of the diplomats said, do you think it's possible that Saudi Arabia would hand over Al-Aqsa to the Israelis as part of normalization of ties with Israel? And my immediate reaction is absolutely not. Why on earth would you ask such a question? And they said, because our Israeli counterparts are telling us that it's going to happen. And I was like, maybe they're speculating. Like, you know, and I said, they go, no, no. There's a difference between maybe, or we're negotiating, or we're talking, or it's possible. They're not saying that. They're talking as if it's a done deal that Al-Aqsa will be handed over to the Israelis. I think that when you look at the way the Saudis are making concessions to the Israelis and the way the UAE are making concessions to the Israelis, and when you look at the way, for example, that Saudi Arabia throughout this genocide can only be described as being, you know, in the Israeli camp, not in the Palestinian camp, whether it's, you know, asking the imams to come up with fatwas to say, you know, don't talk about Gaza because it's a fitna, or whether it's bringing Shakira to dance on the night that the ground offensive begins, or bringing Jared Kushner to give a keynote speech to emphasize that normalization is still on the cards. Jared Kushner said it from the heart of Saudi Arabia. I think that the reason I go easy on King Abdullah of Jordan is because I think that for King Abdullah, he's aware that he's supremely isolated, primarily because he's feeling the pressure even from the Arabs to do something on Al-Aqsa that will favor the Israelis. And that's why when the Saudi ambassador, you know, went to Ramallah and you know, they were trying to get the Palestinians to celebrate a potential normalization with Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah of Jordan protested. Like, he said, you can't normalize over the heads of the Palestinians. Like, this is wrong. Like, you shouldn't be doing this kind of thing. And it's also why the Palestinians refused to allow the Saudi ambassador to pray in Al-Aqsa. So I think King Abdullah of Jordan is genuinely very worried about what's happening in Gaza, doesn't want to see the genocide, wants to see an end to it, but has no power really to do anything, and is desperately navigating pressure that is being brought to bear on him to betray the Palestinians and stab them in the back. And so far, he's resisting that pressure.
We've seen Israel bomb the Syrian airport dozens, if not hundreds of times over the last few years. Syria has been unable to deter Israeli attacks. Clearly weakened by the decade-long civil war and the presence of U.S. troops on their territory, I don't think anyone expects them to join the fight against Israel. Still, Syria has a role to play. Can you help us understand what their position might be?
I think Syria is non-existent. It doesn't exist for it to have a role to play. I think that what Israel is bombing is now an Iranian proxy and Iranian pro-Iranian militias that are in Syria. Assad does not have the power to order a counterattack on Israel, does not have the power to resist Israel. When Israel is bombing Syria, it believes it's bombing Iran. And Iran is deciding whether Syria retaliates or not. Iran is deciding the mobilization of the forces on Syrian territory to apply pressure on Israel. Assad is out of the picture, impotent with no power whatsoever to do anything. On the contrary, Assad is more focused on Idlib and bombing Idlib. At the same time that there's a genocide taking place in Gaza, there's a bombardment of Idlib as he seeks to take advantage of the diversion of attention to the genocide to try to finish off those in Idlib and retake all of Syria. But he's struggling because the Turks are still bombing the Kurdish positions, and the Russians are there and the Americans are there. In other words, I think that when Israel is attacking Syria, I think it has much more to do with Iran. And I think in this particular context, Syria's role is primarily as a launch pad for Iran to keep the pressure up on Israel. And I think in reality, it's a damning indictment on Syria itself. Bashar al-Assad destroyed the whole country. You know, all the people wanted was a chance to choose their rulers and stop, you know, a family rule that lasts 2 decades. He said, I'd rather destroy, burn the whole country than allow the people, you know, to choose their own leaders. And, you know, Syria is now effectively irrelevant.
Hezbollah has exchanged skirmishes and rocket fire with the Israelis for several months now. Despite the overly hyped propaganda videos, there is no doubt that they are applying pressure, even if it is slight. To date, over 100 Hezbollah soldiers have lost their lives in these skirmishes. Lebanon cannot afford another destructive war after decades of instability, hyperinflation, corruption, mismanagement, and the recent catastrophic port explosion. Given this, what role is Hezbollah currently playing? What role might they play next? And what are their interests in this situation?
There's a very interesting timeline of events. So if you remember, Israel delayed its ground offensive. There was all this talk, why, when will it begin? Will it happen? And the like. And one of the reasons they said it will delay is because they were concerned that if they invaded, then Hezbollah and the Iranian proxies would attack from behind, and that Iran was genuinely serious that it would escalate if the Israelis began a ground invasion. Reuters reported that it was leaked that Hummus's Politburo leader, Ismail Haniyeh, went to Tehran. Was it Reuters or Times of Israel? I can't remember. But in any case, like one of the, somebody reported that Ismail Haniyeh had gone to Tehran and asked Khamenei, please, can you, you know, increase your efforts, you know, because we're under pressure. And Khamenei allegedly said to him, you didn't consult us before you did this. You didn't tell us this was happening. You know, we were going through a period of de-escalation, of rapprochement. We were negotiating bin Salman. We were talking to the Americans. We were trying to entrench ourselves. Like, we didn't need this at this moment in time. You didn't tell us this is the maximum that we're going to do. 3 days after that meeting took place, Israel began its ground offensive, suggesting that the Israelis found out that this was the maximum that the, you know, Iranians would do. These are the maximum that the proxies would do. I think it is true that the Iranian proxies are having the greatest impact in frustrating the Israelis. I think it is true that while Israel might believe that this is the maximum Hezbollah will do, the uncertainty or the 1%, 2% that they might do more means that they are leaving troops there on the Lebanese border, and which means they can't concentrate everything on Gaza. Bear in mind, they don't need to, but in any case, Lebanon, it's true, can't afford another war. I think that Hezbollah has sent clear messages that we'll exchange missiles. You hurt us, we'll hurt you. Let's keep it there. We don't want to escalate it too much. And the Americans seem to be settled with this. I think a good example of it would be, you know, the Iran and US exchanging missiles on each other. They each give the locations first before they do it to make sure that they have time to withdraw any personnel who, if they're killed, would result in war. So America, when it retaliated, it gave the locations to the Baghdad government, to Iraq. Iraq, which is de facto under Tehran's influence. And Baghdad, you know, if you give it to Baghdad, it's like you're giving it to Tehran. Tehran moved their personnel out of the areas where America's. And so I think we're seeing that in that. It doesn't mean that they're cooperating with each other. It means they're both saying to each other, listen, please stop. We don't want to escalate. Don't force us to. And you know, they're sort of, who's going to blink first? Game of chicken. You know, who's going to blink first? I think Hezbollah is in that role as well. The Houthis, I think, have had also a huge impact on the Red Sea. There's been exaggeration in that the Houthis have stopped all trade. The Houthis are stopping ships going to the Israelis. And they said, if you stop what's happening in Gaza, we stop what's happening in the Red Sea. Like, it's not a big deal. I think that's why the Houthis are being celebrated by many, and why many Yemenis who have suffered under the Houthis are upset that, you know, Houthis are being celebrated. But in reality, you know, if nobody else is doing something, Palestine has the ability to. But to answer your question, I think that Hezbollah is doing the maximum that it can. It doesn't want an escalation. It's quietly praying that all of this will go away. That's not to take away from what they've done. I do have my opinions on Iranian proxies. I do believe Iranian proxies have killed more of the Sunnah than Israel has Palestinians. I think that, you know, inna fi qalbi inna, like, my heart is not at ease to see those that persecuted the Muslims in Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Lebanon suddenly be presented as champions of Palestine. Having said that, I do understand that, you know, in the absence of other Muslim leaders putting pressure on Israel, their pressure did have some benefit for the Palestinians. And I don't know what else I can say more than that.
The UAE normalized ties with Israel several years ago and has been unapologetic in their relationship, even during the current attack on Gaza. They have admitted that they have no leverage over Israeli actions in Palestine and don't seem to be interested in attaining any. We know they are part of this new trade corridor from India to Haifa, and they are currently helping to facilitate the transfer of goods to Israel over land through this corridor. What are the UAE's interests in the region, and why do they insist on this relationship with Israel?
Put it simply, the UAE insists on preserving normalization of ties because they're benefiting emphatically from normalization of ties. The whole purpose of normalization with Israel, in the words of the former Qatari Prime Minister Hamad bin Jassim in a France 24 interview in 2018, he said, when the Arabs get close to the Israelis, it's not because they like the Israelis. It's because they believe that Israel is the key to the White House and Congress. If you think about what UAE is doing in Libya, in Sudan, in Somalia, in Ethiopia, in Eritrea, in Chad, in Mali, Mali not so much, but in Chad, if you look at what the UAE is doing elsewhere, in Yemen or the like, you'd be hard-pressed to find Congress condemning any of it, even though it's pretty outrageous, like what's happening. And the reason being is the UAE believes that normalization ensures absolute impunity in Congress and the White House. That for them, normalization with Arab state is so important that it's not worth provoking or antagonizing Abu Dhabi. Which is why, for example, in Sudan, where you have a situation where the Bashir's government fell, and then Washington and UAE came together and they said, guys, if we allow elections here, the Sudanese, they will vote for Islamic-leaning parties. Remember, as bin Zayed said in that article, in the New York Times article, The Dark Prince of the Middle East, he said that, you know, these are people who believe a 1400-year-old book should be a constitution. The implication is, do you really want these people to vote and choose their leader? So in Sudan, they got together, they got parties that would never win an election, leftist liberal parties, allied with the generals, the two commanders that toppled al-Bashir, and they made a transition agreement. They removed Israel, they removed Islam from the constitution, they normalized ties with Israel, and then they fell out with each other because the general didn't want to hand over power to the political parties. Instead of going to elections, they decided to do new negotiations, and then when the UAE got frustrated with the general who refused to hand over power, they asked the militia, you know, can you go and plunge the country into war and go and get rid of that general? That's preferable to us than elections, because we don't want Sudanese to choose their leaders. America knows all of this, but Congress doesn't say anything about it, or very rarely says anything about it, and doesn't actually call UAE out, because normalization is so important. They don't want to jeopardize that normalization of ties. So the UAE believes, why am I going to compromise the impunity that I have secured through normalization of ties with Israel for the sake of Palestinians who aren't really going anywhere anyway? I think that's why for the UAE, they believe that the Abraham Accords are absolutely fundamental and essential, not because of any peace, they don't really care about the peace or not, but because of what the Israelis are providing in America in terms of the White House and Congress, where the UAE is becoming one of the primary influences on US foreign policy itself. The UAE also says, look, you know, like Qatar 1996, first country to willingly normalize, and you know, Qatar was the first country to receive an Israeli president in 2006 when Shimon Peres went to visit them. Sadat went to Israel, but Shimon Peres came to Qatar. So, you know, and the UAE says, you know, many scholars, they made excuses for it, like no problem, like it's, and that's why even bin Salman is considering, he sees the impunity that, you know, UAE gets to enjoy, and he says this is, you know, with normalization of Israel, and you know, there are scholars justifying normalization and saying it might be a good thing, maybe I can do the same thing as well. So the UAE, they say, listen, like at the end of the day, we've benefited from the Israelis, we're not interested in this Palestinian cause, like we're not, we believe it can be resolved with just a bit of money, like spraying money here and there, and you know, what's happening in Gaza, if we have to make a statement, we'll make one. If we don't, UAE, like Saudi, will take the brunt of what's happening as well. I think that's the sad tragedy, because you think that UAE, in my opinion, is one of the countries that can end the genocide tomorrow if it wanted to. If it kicked out the Israeli ambassador and reversed the Abraham Accords, I think the Americans would panic. And they would tell the Israelis, stop, 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 we need to preserve that. That's how you use normalization in favor of the Palestinians. That's the leverage that they have that we choose not to use. But the UAE, at the end of the day, they say we have more important priorities. We want to become like the new Venice of this era. All these ports, you know, in Somalia, they've recently brokered an agreement with Somaliland to provide a strip of land for Ethiopia to access the sea, something that has angered Somalia. You know, they're everywhere. And there was an article that came out that said the UAE now is a major player in East Africa, and that's not a good thing. The idea being that the UAE is expanding all this, and the UAE says the reason it's able to do so without normalization, it would be criticized heavily in Washington. But with normalization, it's able to do what it wants. So it says, why should I compromise all of these gains that I'm making for the sake of Palestinians who, they argue, don't appreciate anything that I did before? I know it sounds tragic, but I think that's the UAE position. The Palestinians are not worth it.
It's no secret that Saudi Arabia was close to a normalization deal with Israel, and many argue that behind the scenes, this deal is still very much real and will continue after the situation in Gaza dies down. One of the stated objectives of Operation Al-Aqsa Flood was to disrupt normalization talks and remind the region of the importance of the Palestinian cause. What is Saudi's position in all of this, and why are they interested in normalization with Israel?
Saudi are interested in normalization for two reasons. They have an existential economic crisis and an existential security crisis from their perspective. The existential economic crisis is easily understood if you put yourself in the position of bin Salman. 2017, you come to power. 2018, you come to America, you meet everybody who's anybody. You meet all these tech guys, and Saudi Arabia is a new thing. But in 2018, you kill Khashoggi, or allegedly kill Khashoggi. As a result, companies don't come rushing to invest in your Vision 2030. 2019, Houthis fire missiles, they hit your oil facility. So companies aren't coming because it's not safe. 2020, COVID hits, so nobody's investing anyway. 2021, Biden comes to power in January, calls you a pariah, and then the companies aren't coming. 2022, Biden comes to reset relations, but talks about Khashoggi when he's with you in Jeddah. So companies are hesitant, what's going on over here? Not only that, companies are setting up in UAE to do business in Saudi Arabia, which means that Bin Salman turns around, he imposes tariffs on the border with UAE to tell people you can't just do business, it's expensive if you want to stay in the UAE, and also says anybody who doesn't have a headquarters in Saudi Arabia will have to, anyone who doesn't have a headquarters in Saudi Arabia cannot pitch for government contracts, they cannot win government tenders. Then the Saudi Crown Prince, twice in the year, he just randomly does spot checks on the UAE border, meaning trucks are lingering there for like a week to tell companies that I'm unpredictable. If you want to do business in UAE, no, you have to like do business like here. He has to take in an enlarged dividend from Aramco in 2022-2023. I could have made, I'm sure it's 2023, to shore up the budget. And he has to restructure the public investment fund because it's making losses. The point is 2017 to 2024 where we are now, Vision 2030 is not moving in the way that you wanted it to move. You're still heavily reliant on oil price. You still need, I don't know, $80, $90, $100 like a barrel in order to, you know, balance your budgets. All that talk about Vision 2030 and your diversification is not taking place in the way that it is, and companies are not eagerly running to you. The companies that are going to Saudi Arabia are taking your checks to build, but they are not investing the money to stay. They're not investing in, they're taking money from Saudi Arabia itself. Bin Salman believes that if he normalizes ties with Israel, he can resolve the issue in Congress and the White House. And Israel, when those companies come, they'll bring with them the American companies for Vision 2030. Because Bin Salman says Vision 2030 is supposed to look like Miami, not Shanghai or Moscow, like Miami. He makes the Miami reference in his own documentary when he talks about NEOM and the projects. The existential security crisis is that when you open the map of Saudi Arabia, to the north you have those 23 pro-Iran militias that have fired rockets in the past at Saudi Arabia, whose leader in 2019, Abu Mahdi Mohandes, who was killed by Donald Trump, said that the target before Al-Aqsa is Riyadh. Riyadh is the target first. He told a group of students in Tehran. To the east, you have Iran itself, which always threatens to shut the Hormuz Strait, from which the 8% of the oil goes through. And the south, you have the Houthis, who are now essentially entrenched, like in northern Yemen, who have fired missiles at you. Saudi Arabia believes it's in a pincer. Saudi Arabia's security has always been outsourced to the Americans. But when the Houthis hit in 2019, when they hit the Abqaiq oil facility, they expected the Americans to react. The Americans didn't react. So the Saudis entered into negotiations with the Iranians to say, listen, guys, like, I just need a five-year truce. Iranians, they said, we need to see sincerity. Bring Assad back to the Arab League. He said, Hadr, I'll bring Assad back to the Arab League. Invest in Iraq because they need to pay our electricity bill. They need money, put money there so they can pay us. So he put $6 billion in Iraq and it goes to the Iranians afterwards. The Iranians say, talk to the Houthis and consider compensation. But halas, I'll talk to the Houthis, whatever. When the Israelis suggest normalization in exchange for a NATO-style security agreement, the negotiations slow down between Saudi and Iran, because now Bin Salman is thinking, hang on a second, if I can secure the NATO-style security agreement, I don't need to be humiliated by Iran, like I don't need to continue these talks. During the process, of course, he's also sent Cristiano Ronaldo to Tehran, you know, as a gift, like as well, like to play a football match over there. Bin Salman believes that these existential crises require Israel in order to resolve them, and that therefore his relationship with Israel is not worth compromising for the sake of the Palestinians. And that's what I think is the tragedy, in that in order to allay the fears of Israel, Bin Salman has proactively told the Israelis and Americans that normalization is still on the cards. Whether it's bringing Jared Kushner to give a keynote speech, whether it's continuing with the concerts and the raves, whether it's getting imams to say don't talk about Gaza, whether it's informing tourism boards that they shouldn't bring kafirs or free Gaza stickers to Saudi Arabia, although after the public backlash, it looks like they've calmed down, they're not arresting as many people anymore or confronting many people with regards to the kafirs or the like. The Saudi Crown Prince believes that normalization with Israel is the way forward, and he also believes he can do it. He wants to de-Islamize the kingdom, you know, lowering the loudspeakers to 33% of the volume for the adhan, banning them for being used for the Quran, banning all masajid from broadcasting Taraweeh prayers except Mecca Medina, although Mecca Medina was a concession after a backlash when people thought it would Mecca Medina be included. The reason being is that Bin Salman was frustrated that while he's doing all the raves and parties or the like, if you do hashtag Saudi on TikTok, you're just seeing Qaris like from Riyadh, from Dammam, from whatever. He wanted to limit and restrict that to give greater viewership for the raves and the concerts. So he said, let's leave it to Mecca Medina, so you have the hashtag Mecca Medina, while hashtag Saudi can be limited to, or can be exclusive to, Red Sea Resort, Iggy Azalea twerking, Nicki Minaj, if she ever accepts an invitation, she rejected the first one. Or for example, Shakira coming to dance, or Tyson Fury and Ngannou, or the like. It's about, you know, changing Saudi Arabia's image, or the like. Saudi Crown Prince has been proactively reassuring the Israelis that, look, I want good ties. I'm ready to normalize. Just give me the three things. Give me the NATO-style security agreement against Iran, because they're a threat to me, not the Israelis. Give me a nuclear technology to build a nuclear weapon. And give me support for Vision 2030. Make your companies come and invest. And Biden, before October 7th, actually, told that it was Reuters that reported it. He told the Saudis that, I can't give you NATO-style security agreement, but I can give you a status like Bahrain, where we deploy a fleet that's exclusively designed to defend you. And Netanyahu was also reportedly to have agreed to with the Americans to give nuclear technology to the Saudis in exchange for normalization of ties. So the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman says to himself, listen, like, I'm on the verge of resolving these two existential crises through normalization of ties with Israel. And not only that, if the Ummah made excuses for Qatar and UAE, why won't they make excuses for me? For example, the introduction of alcohol in Saudi Arabia. When the Qataris did the World Cup, remember initially they said no alcohol, and then they made a concession, they allowed alcohol in certain areas. There were some Saudis who commented on it at the time, and they said, you know, this might be the way we can introduce alcohol, because look, there's no backlash. Qatar is being celebrated for introducing alcohol, but in limited places. Maybe we can do the same in Saudi Arabia itself. And sure enough, 1 year or 2 years later, now they're introducing alcohol, but for diplomats only. It's like gradually. Mm-hmm. There was a sheikh, he made like a semi-joke. He said to me, the Quran got rid of it gradually, bin Salman is reintroducing it gradually.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that when you look at the, you know, bin Salman is going towards a particular direction, and he believes Israel is at the heart of it, and he believes he could find an Islamic justification for normalization. He has imams who could find him any Islamic justification, and he believes that these two existential crises are not worth compromising for Palestine. He's already, you know, pressuring Jordan. He's already working with the Israelis. He's already allowed the Israeli national anthem at the EA Sports tournament. He allowed the Israeli sports team to participate in the Dakar rally in 2021. He's allowed Israeli delegation to go to Medina. He allowed the Hindutva delegation as well, like, to go to Medina as well, Medina Munawwara. The trajectory is clear, and I think bin Salman is just not as interested in, you know, ummatic issues anymore. For him, it's not relevant for him. He's very pragmatic, Machiavellian. I need Israel to solve my two existential crises. I'm not going to compromise that for Palestine.
Do you view the existential crisis as being serious enough to merit even the consideration of this normalization?
My issue with the existential crises is not that I deny them. I believe they are legitimate fears, genuinely. I don't deny that at all. I do think that Iran is an imminent threat to Saudi Arabia, 100%. I believe the economy badly needs to be diversified, 100%. What I disagree with is the methodology through which he's decided to resolve those two. The reason Iran has a project in the region, this idea of, you know, Khomeini, I think it was Khomeini who once put it, he said, Allah gave the Khilafah to the Arabs, the Turks, the Kurds, the Berbers, and this is the time for the Persians. Iran has a project that unites the Shia in the region. So much so that you can't buy Hassan Nasrallah. You can't buy Muqtada Sadr. You can't buy Houthis. Saudis have tried. They've spent millions trying to buy these organized. They can't buy them because they believe in an ideology. Hassan Nasrallah crossed over the border from Lebanon to Syria and rescued Bashar al-Assad in 2013-2014 in Qusay, knowing full well he was about to lose all of the credit that he'd got from the Sunni world from his war with Israel in 2006-2008, I think. So for him, the loyalty to the cause was worth compromising all of that goodwill because they believe in something. Saudis don't have an equivalent project. My issue, for example, is that, for example, when you look at the economic diversification, there's so much in the Muslim world that you could diversify. You could have opened the visa and let the Muslims go to Mecca, Medina, and then go to Taif and go to Tabuk and go to these other places. In terms of startups, you don't need the Israelis or the likes to do your startup. You have startups, you can invest it in Singapore and these other places or the like and do your own and set up like your own model. You don't need to de-Islamize Saudi Arabia in order to achieve that, you know, grandeur. If the issue was perhaps the strict interpretation of Saudi Arabia, the solution is not to go from, you know, strict interpretation to bikini beaches in Jeddah. It's to shift it, you know, away, like through scholarly discussion and the like. That's why I don't deny the urgency of the existential crisis in Saudi Arabia. And I think it would be unfair for anybody to do that. I just believe that bin Salman's approach to resolving them is one that will lead to even more disaster for Saudi Arabia itself. I mean, you consider, bin Salman had come out and said, you know, Bismillah, wa salatu wa salam, I said, Rasulullah, we will not tolerate the genocide, and we're taking a position, and we've gathered leaders. He would have been a hero. People would have forgiven him for all those concerts. They would have forgiven him for standing on top of the Kaaba. They would have forgiven him for all the things. I would have said, you know what, mashallah, butter, like, he's doing something now. But you feel like bin Salman, his vision of Saudi Arabia is one in which Islam is no longer part of the identity. When he changes the date of the founding of the kingdom from 1744 to 1727, 1744, the Saudis used to always say that the Saudi Arabia was established in 1744 when Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab shakes hands with Muhammad Al Saud, and they make a pact in which they agree to re-establish Quran and Sunnah in Saudi Arabia. Whatever you think of them is irrelevant. I'm saying that the Saudis point to the founding of their kingdom as a pact to uphold Islam, which is why the Saudi princes would always say, Allah gave us dominion because we agreed to go out and uphold Islam, and why King Salman, when he was Emir of Riyadh, he wrote in 2008 in the Riyadh newspaper, he wrote that the founding of Saudi Arabia was not a tribal endeavor, nor what is a human ideological endeavor. It was an Islamic endeavor to establish Quran and Sunnah. Whether it's true or not is irrelevant. The point is, where they see the Saudi identity rooted in. Bin Salman changed from 1744 to 1727, which is the year that Muhammad Al Saud becomes leader of the clan in a small town outside of Riyadh called Dir'iyya. And the emblem that he uses to celebrate it is a horse, a palm tree, a door, and a souq, like a market. And the flag he puts in the middle has like no writing in it. So he's saying this is what represents Saudi Arabia. There's no Islamic symbolism. Even the picture that he uses of Dir'iyya to explain the emblem doesn't have any minarets on it. The point is, like, there's this clear, he believes that to resolve the existential crisis, he needs to divorce the Saudi identity from Islam. He needs to create a new nationalist Saudi identity that is divorced from the Islamic undertones that define the Saudi identity. Whether you agree or not is irrelevant, but that define the Saudi identity. King Abdulaziz of Saudi Arabia, who founded the latest kingdom, when they visit him in Mina, they said to him, you know, people, they call you Wahhabis. He said, they call us Wahhabis, but we're not. We're just conservative Muslims that set out to establish Quran and Sunnah. Again, whether you agree or not is irrelevant. My point is, look at how they define the Saudi idea. They defined it as rooted in something that is Islam. Bin Salman is saying, no, it's not rooted in Islam. It's rooted in tribal endeavor. It's rooted in being Saudi, being Arabi, being... Islam is sort of a side thing that you put on the side. And that's where I think that... I think if Saudi divorces from its Islamic identity, I don't think they'll have the means to resolve those two existential crises, because what it will do instead is, in a region where Islam remains the primary idea that the region sympathizes with, and the proof is that after 90 years of top-down secularism in Tunisia, first free and fair elections, Islamist parties win. Egypt, after all of those movies and Abdel Nasser laughing at the hijab and that kind of stuff and whatnot, first free and fair elections, Islamists win. Libya, the Islamists came second officially, but you count those 70 independent candidates, Islamic leading, you know, individuals, they come first. Wherever you go, whoever says, you know, I'm holding the flag of Islam, they're the ones who get supported. I think in a region, that's what you need to tap into to get the support that you need in order to resolve those existential crises. And that's where I think, I don't deny that Bin Salman has existential crises. I don't deny that he needs to move urgently to fix them. I don't deny that there's anything wrong with economic diversification. I think that his conclusion that the solution is to divorce the identity from Islam is what is going to be catastrophic for Saudi Arabia.
It's understood that Israel wants to push the people of Gaza into the Sinai Desert, or at least they wanted to. They tried during the Trump era, and they have been speaking openly about it now. We know Egypt has $162 billion in debt. There have been suggestions that the U.S. and Israel would help arrange to have that debt wiped or reduced somehow. Can you talk to us about Egypt's position in this current situation and what their interests are?
Sisi is aware that if he opens that border and the Palestinians come rushing through and they set up in the Sinai Desert in refugee camps, he knows that Israel will never allow them to return to Gaza again. He's also aware he will go down in history as being considered a collaborator who helped with the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. Sisi knows that categorically he cannot help to facilitate the Palestinians leaving Gaza. Of course, I say that. The stories of the borders are that if you pay $9,000 to the Egyptians on the border, you can cross. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Sisi is telling them to take those bribes. I think it just shows the state of affairs in Egypt, where you can bypass everything by paying bribes. When Blinken went to visit Sisi, if you remember his first visit to Tel Aviv, and then he was supposed to go back to Washington, then he went back to Saudi Arabia. And he went to Saudi Arabia, he got the fatwa, don't talk about Gaza because it's a fitna. He went to UAE, he got a statement condemning the Palestinians. But when he went to Egypt, expecting the same sort of response that he got from Saudi and the UAE, he got the opposite. Sisi turned on the camera and lambasted Blinken for 45 minutes. Tell him, what do you mean you came to Tel Aviv? You said, I'm here as a Jew. We never persecuted the Jews here. That's something unique to you Europeans. Touché to whatever you think of Sisi, it was a decent speech. Not only that, when Blinken suggested that they open the border and take in the Palestinians, Sameh Shukri, the foreign minister, told it, the Financial Times reported that Sameh Shukri had told someone privately, or told the gathering privately, that if they force us to take the Palestinians, we'll load the Palestinians on boats and send them straight to Europe. Like, we won't be forced into this. When Blinken went back to Washington, Blinken seemed to have interpreted it as a money issue. And that's where the rumors came out that the US might forgive some debt or ease the debt. In reality, what happened was Biden on the 20th of October proposed to Congress a $14 billion bill in which that money would be given to Egypt and Jordan in order to facilitate funding those tents for the Palestinians. But on the 28th of October, Biden came out and said, we no longer support the displacement of the Palestinians. And I thought Biden was lying because he lied about the beheaded babies. But John Kirby confirmed it the next day. The reason being is that Sisi dug his heels in. He made it absolutely clear, I'm not willing to take in like those Palestinians and come across the border. Sisi has a problem in that he doesn't enjoy popular support. He has an economic crisis on his hands, and Egypt is boiling. Like, the people are boiling. There was a video, I think, of an Egyptian guy walking through an area, you know, like where apartment blocks are. And he's saying, yeah, ibadallah, you know, like there's a genocide taking place in Gaza right across the border, and we can't do anything like that. And everybody's crying around him, you know, like coming out the windows. Like, you could feel like people are very angry. Sisi's issue is that economically, none of his mega projects have worked. He did an early election because he knows he has to devalue the Egyptian pound, which is going to make things even harder for ordinary Egyptians, but it's a requirement in order to seek external help for his economy. The interesting thing is, why did he have to do an early election if he was completely in power? He did the early election so that no rival of his can use the election as a means to topple him later when he devalues the pound and the people decide to protest or riot, which shows that Sisi believes, that election showed that Sisi believes he's not in complete control as he would like to be. So that was a betrayal of weakness. Sisi believes that he's being treated unfairly by the Israelis and the Americans, that he helped them to blockade Gaza. He helped them with intelligence efforts. He helped them to contain Hamas. He helped them to contain the Palestinian people. He collaborated and you know, worked with them on security and the like. You know, he was a good friend to them. There was a Wall Street Journal article in 2015, I think I remember, where Israeli officials complained to the Americans and they said Sisi is too eager to squeeze the Palestinians. If he keeps going the way he is, they're going to explode and he's going to bring a war on us. I tell Sisi, calm down, don't be so excited. Like, Mubarak used to close the border and leave the tunnels. This guy's flooding the tunnels as well. Like, come on, like, give him a bit of air to breathe. We're squeezing on this side, give them some air. I think Sisi feels like he's not being appreciated by the Americans or the Israelis. Having said that, the interesting thing is it has pushed Sisi to develop closer ties with Hamas, because that gives him leverage as a mediator to talk to them. And I think Sisi's in an awkward position whereby when he thought that maybe Palestine might give him popular legitimacy, remember, he allowed protests for the first time since 2014, he lifted the restrictions. He was hoping that the people would protest for Palestine. He knew it was a gamble. He was worried that people would take to the streets in huge numbers for Palestine, but then go to Medina Tahrir and they would protest against him instead. Which is what happened. People protested for Palestine, and then like a group of them went to Tahrir Square. He went, okay. Like, it's clear, like, the people are not with me. If I allow them to protest for Palestine, they will come and protest against me instead, and they will topple me instead. And that's why Sisi is in this very awkward situation whereby he keeps saying to Egyptian people, be grateful for what you have. Be grateful you're not Gaza. Be great. He went to Somalia, next to the Somalian, you know, president. And the Somalian president said, thank you for your cooperation. And in front of the Somalian president, he speaks to the camera and he says, to my Egyptian people, I send you a message. Somalia fell into chaos in 1991-92, and they've never recovered since. They're always in chaos. Like, he's offending the Somalis. He's like, he goes, do you want to be like that? Like, he's like, you know, you need to like appreciate me. Like, no, it's really like, when you read it, you're like, wow. Like, it's the, but Sisi feels isolated from his people, from the Americans, from the Israelis, from the UAE, which is bullying him in Sudan. Bin Zayed went to visit Egypt 3 days before Sudan plunged into war. And what was fascinating is that none of us could understand why Bin Zayed went to Sisi, because they were arguing over economic like investments and stuff like that. And then 3 days later, the war begins, and the UAE's, you know, UAE-backed militia in Sudan, they detain 80 Egyptian soldiers in Marawi Airport in Khartoum. which is humiliating for Sisi. And everybody knows it's the UAE that have held them hostage to strong-arm Sisi into not intervening to rescue the general who they support. So Egypt is with the general and UAE is with the militia trying to topple the general. Sisi is in such an awkward position that when the 80 soldiers were released, the Egyptian statement thanked the UAE. Like, thank the UAE, which orchestrated, but thank the UAE for releasing those hostages to show you how Sisi feels like he's not in a position to mobilize anyway. And that's why I think that, to sum up Sisi, it's not that he cares about Palestinians or Gaza. Like, Sisi feels like, I invested so much with the Israelis and Americans, and now look how they're treating me. UAE and Saudi are no longer investing in me because they invested like more than 30 billion like over the past like 10 years. They received nothing, and they're openly saying that they won't invest in me anymore unless the army gives up some of its control over the economy. And if I tell the army to give up some of its control over the economy, they might lash out at me and replace me. So Sisi looks right, he has trouble. Looks left, he has trouble. Looks up, he has trouble. Looks down, and he has no idea what to do except go on TV and tell the Egyptian people, Egyptians, please understand that we're in a difficult position, but you need to appreciate me because I will guide you out of this position. And, you know, at this moment, his only leverage is communications with Hummus and the hope that somehow he will... Even now, the Israelis now, they're sending troops. So aid, when it goes into Gaza, it goes past the Egyptian border. But then it has to be inspected by the Israelis, who are right on his border with Rafah. Like, it's humiliating for an Egyptian army that the Israelis are there and, you know, on the Egyptian side, they're the ones controlling the border. But it also speaks volumes as to Sisi's weakness, that he's unable to actually do anything. Having said that, he might have a potential outlet. The Erdogan, there's reports that he might meet Sisi. Mm. And that Turkey and Egypt might cooperate together on economic projects or the like. And Erdogan is reaching out to Sisi to say, I know you're isolated as well. Maybe we can work together on multiple projects. Where that goes, who knows? But yeah, Sisi is in a very difficult position.
Sounds like all of the leaders are, with the exception maybe of MBS. He has maybe some more creative freedom too.
But on that point, they're all in a difficult position. That doesn't mean they don't have the power to do anything. I truly believe that if Saudi said tomorrow that as a result of 30,000 Palestinians being killed through a genocide, that's a red line. There's no normalization talks here. And if UAE said Abraham Accords was never supposed to facilitate 30,000 Palestinians killed, we're kicking out the Israeli ambassador and we're reversing normalization of ties. And if Morocco comes out and it says you haven't even delivered on Western Sahara, so the normalization was useless anyway, and you've killed 30,000 Palestinians, red line, we're kicking out Israeli ambassador. I think the Americans tomorrow would rush to Tel Aviv and say, stop it, you're about to undo the deals of the century. I truly believe it. That's why when people say they want Muslim countries to go to war, they don't need to. They don't need to send armies. They have the ability without armies to stop the genocide. But they choose not to. They choose not to. That's why there are people who are suggesting, you know, that, you know, maybe normalization in exchange for end to genocide. The reason I don't accept the argument is because that argument should only be considered when we've already used the powers that are at our disposal. The Muslim leaders haven't. And it's not because they don't have it. It's not because they're worried about using it. It's because genuinely they don't want to. Bin Salman has no inclination to. It's not because he's worried about the backlash. He doesn't want to use it. UAE is not worried about the backlash. If UAE reverses normalization tomorrow, there won't be a backlash. There will be a begging tour from US delegation to UAE to say, please, please, please reverse course. The same way that Biden sent the highest level delegation to the funeral of Mohammed bin Zayed's brother who died, the former president, Khalifa bin Zayed, I think. He sent the vice president, his chief in the Congress. He sent the head of CIA. He sent defense secretary. He sent Blinken. He sent all that to say to bin Zayed, I'm sorry, please, let's reset ties. So when the suggestion that, and maybe you didn't intend to make it, but when the suggestion is that the Muslim leaders could move, but they're worried about the consequences, my issue is the Muslim leaders have tools at their disposal that they could use without the consequences that they fear. But they're choosing not to do so because they are in the Zionist camp. They are choosing not to do so because they're standing willingly, proactively, with the Israelis, because it's not because they see it as a short term. They see their future with the Israelis. They see themselves as new age visionaries that moves beyond Islam and beyond Islamic issues to an age in which the only thing that matters to an individual is a 9-to-5 job, salary in his pocket, and entertainment in the nighttime. They believe that's the pinnacle of man. When the UAE opposes the Arab Spring, it's not opposing the Arab Spring because, you know, it says, you know, the people, you know, shouldn't have freedom or like. The UAE says that the people don't want democracy. They don't want to choose their leaders. You're mistaken. What people want is economic prosperity. And that's where Bin Ali failed. That's where Mubarak failed. Let me build them Abu Dhabi and Dubai and see. They won't ask me for freedom. they'll be willing to live like sheep that go to work and be entertained and go home. You keep telling about rights. These people don't want rights. They just want money. And that's the vision. Even Vision 2030. What is Vision 2030? It's entertainment. It's concerts. It's the idea of having a job, money in your pocket, and going to entertainment. And that's the pinnacle of life. Nothing beyond that. You know, very... And that's the issue that I have, is that if they were trying to do something, but they were worried about the consequences, maybe Erdogan slightly maybe has that. But even then, like, there are things he could do that perhaps he shouldn't have, that he should have done. I think it's humiliating that the Israelis had to withdraw the ambassador rather than him kicking out the ambassador. But the point is, they have power to do something without the consequences that you're suggesting they might suffer. But they choose not to do so. And that's why you cannot tell the story of the genocide without talking about the phenomenal betrayal of the Arab leaders, which is so outrageous, especially when you consider the lengths that they went to, including deploying the imams of the state to come out and find Islamic rulings to say, don't talk about Gaza because it's fitna, make dua, maybe add tears for added effect, but don't talk about it because it might turn you against your leader, and you should trust that your leader knows what they're doing, even if they bring Shakira to dance on the night of the ground invasion. It's not the leaders are worried about the consequences. They're choosing not to do anything about the genocide. Trust nothing. No.